In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Boston's legendary Nervous Eaters have a new album out on Wicked Cool Records titled Rock and Roll Your Heart Away, and it features our recent coolest song of the world, Inside Out. The band features two guitars, founding member Steve Cataldo, who I spoke with earlier this year, and Adam Sherman. The latter is my guest today, and we'll start chatting after we take a listen to a little bit of Inside Out on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it is time for your coolest conversations. Joining me is Adam Sherman. He's one of two guitarists in Boston's legendary Nervous Eaters. The other is founding member Steve Cataldo. The band's new album, Rock and Roll Your Heart Away, is out now on Wicked Cool Records, and the cut off it, Inside Out, is this week's coolest song in the world. How are you, Adam?
I'm great. How are you, Manfred?
How's it going? I'm doing pretty good. I am very happy to be chatting with you. You know, well, first of all, congratulations on the new album on Rock and Roll Your Heart Away.
Thank you so much. You know, we're kind of thrilled. It's all been a nice ride here, so thanks.
Well, this is the second album since Steve reformed the band. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, the first being Monsters and Angels. That's from 2022?
Right.
Okay, well, like Steve, you've got a lot of rock and roll history on the Boston music scene. I know back in the 70s, you had a band, Private Lightning, and you've had other projects. But you're not actually from Boston originally?
Well, I grew up right outside New York. Literally born in New York City, started my life in Bayside, Queens, and then my parents moved to New Hyde Park, Long Island, which is just outside New York City. So I'm a New Yorker, but I came to Boston to play music, to play at the Rat in Kenmore Square.
Well, before we get you in Boston, let me find out some about when you were growing up. When did you first pick up a guitar?
I you know, I saw the Beatles, and I was playing piano. My parents had me on, and I was eight years old, and I just said I want a guitar, and they were cool. They were into me being a creative little kid, and they got me a guitar. And I just started playing when I was 8 years old.
So you saw the Beatles. Now, do you mean you saw them on Ed Sullivan?
Oh, just on Ed Sullivan, like everybody else, yeah. You know, everybody that's my age had the same, they've got the same story, basically. They turned on that black and white TV and their lives changed forever.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is over the course of me doing these interviews, just as you said, if you're of a certain age, that is the moment. That is always the go-to moment. And it's interesting for people that know, come along afterwards, there isn't this great cultural, signal point, you know, it's just very interesting afterwards. In fact, what's also interesting is that there've been some people I've spoken to that I would never have thought that would have been the sort of epiphany, like Peter Buck, who I thought would have been, you know, too young for that. Apparently he was quite young, but he was watching Ed Sullivan and made some announcement after it was done that that's what he was going to pursue. And his parents are like, aren't you sweet? Aren't you cute?
Right.
Okay. So do you have any siblings?
I don't. I'm an only child. It's just me.
And you mentioned your parents being supportive in your creative endeavors. Was there, do either of them play instruments?
They're not musical, but they were both artists in one way or another. My father was a design director and my mother was a painter. And so there was a lot of creativity around me. What there was the albums that they would play. And one of the ones that my mother loved Ravi Shankar, but she also loved The Times They Are A-Changin' by Bob Dylan. So I was getting this esoteric mix of things, and they dug the Beatles too. It's, you know, when we all kind of had the same musical taste after the Beatles, we were listening to AM radio in New York City, which was pretty great at that time. A lot of Beatles and Beach Boys, Marvin Gaye, a lot of Motown, Tammy Terrell, you know, it was good stuff.
So you start playing, or you pick up the guitar at eight. Were you taking lessons?
My mom got me lessons, yeah. And I took lessons for a year. I have a little story about the lessons. Back then, guitar teachers were kind of hard. They were kind of esoteric. They were kind of hard to find. And she found this guy kind of in the neighborhood. And he turned out to be sort of a really conservative. He was a young man, but he was very conservative. And my mom took me to this little music store, and I picked out the music that I wanted to play, which was, sheet music for The Eve of Destruction.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
yeah.
He
the
would
Barry
not.
McGuire hit.
Yeah. And he, and you know, this was just, for me, this was just a song. This was good. I wasn't protesting. I was eight. And, he wouldn't teach me. The guitar teacher wouldn't teach that. He actually stepped out, spoke to my mother and said, you know, this is inappropriate music here and I won't teach that to him. So I didn't learn that, but I stopped taking guitar lessons. And the first thing I did was I learned Universal Soldier by Phil Oakes and, you know, Barry McGuire and whatever. Barry McGuire was not exactly a protest guy, but still he sang The Eve of Destruction. So
he sang the song. And so you were, then the guitar you were learning on was an acoustic guitar?
At first it was acoustic, but you know how it is. You're 8 years old, there's the Beatles, and you got to get an electric guitar. So eventually, it didn't take very long for me to convince them. It's got to be that. And, you know, you get the electric guitar first, and then you kind of go, well, I'm going to have an amp to play this. So then there's an amp, you know, and it just goes on and on like that.
Well, what was the first electric guitar and your first amp?
Was a Supro guitar, which now are esoteric, hard to find, expensive. This was like a Japanese little kind of three-quarter size, lovely guitar, a Supro, and the amp was a Univox. And what it had, it didn't have reverb, but it was loud and it had tremolo. So I was totally cool with that.
Oh, right. So was this the rig that you started playing in bands with? Or did you have any high school bands?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, several high school bands. We had a high school band. This is kind of embarrassing now, but our high school band, the one that was the most advanced and, you know, rehearsed and had songs, was we took the name from the I don't know if he was the first mate on in Moby Dick, and his name was Starbuck. And this was way before Starbucks coffee, so we called the band Starbuck, and you know, we were advanced, I guess, you know. So our
how old were you? How old were you when Starbuck first formed?
I would say Starbuck would have been more like 11 years old. And before that, there was a band called jade looking glass. And that was literally 9 years old. That was 9 years old. Yeah.
And I love that you guys were so literary.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were around some, the influences at that time had pretty good taste. So yeah. We were aware of the fact that, you know, we were dealing with our satanic majesties, whatever, you know, and so we were kind of thinking about a lot of stuff. Anyway, yeah, and we were writing songs too. This was one of the things, and this is, it goes back to the Beatles. My friends at that time, our orientation was, you create this music, you know, you write the songs and you sing the songs, which was very different than what came before that. Bobby right. Darin or, you know, Bobby Vinton, you know, people that were singing songs composed by renowned songwriters and stuff. This idea that the Beatles came in with and the Beach Boys picked up on, the Stones, you're writing your own tunes. We just bought that. We just said, all right, well, that's how you do it. We didn't really go into it doing covers. We went into it thinking, oh, we have to write the songs too. Plus the to do covers then was hard. You know, you had to be better than we were to be able to cover a Beatles song. So right, we'd write right. these songs that we could, you know, inhabit. And
so did Starbuck come to an end as you graduated, or did you try and pursue that past graduation?
That came to an end with graduation. Yeah, we were playing high school dances and stuff. And, you know, I left New York right when I was 17. So I had just, I tried a semester of art school in Brooklyn at Pratt. And it wasn't for me, and I wanted to be playing music. And so mm-hmm. I split and came to Boston when I was 17. So right out of high school, I knew I wanted to play music.
And well, why did you go to Boston?
Because you know, being a college town, as opposed to sort of, I mean, New York's got colleges and stuff, but New York at the time was kind of dead. This was right before CBGBs really happened. Okay. And there wasn't much for a local musician, for a young local musician to do in the city at that time. A lot of cover bands, hair bands, the Cat Club, I don't know. And we heard that there was this new scene in Boston with the Rat, and that there were all these clubs. And it was true. The Rat was happening, but there were a lot of clubs in Boston where you could, after about a year of being here, the clubs started to allow bands to play original material, which you couldn't do for a while. You had to play covers. And as soon as we started to play clubs that fostered original material, things got interesting. And there started to be bands that were really good because of the material that they were writing and playing.
Well, this band, Private Lightning, when did it get started?
Started probably, 80, so like 70, 77, 77, 78, something like that. It took us a couple of years to really get our stuff together.
Well, I wanted to find out, so as you guys, you'd formed Private Lightning, and you had an album on A&M, came out like in 1980. First about that, you know, you had a record that came out on a major label. Did you find that a good or a bad experience?
Well, you know, it was great to get signed. We had a honeymoon period. We recorded at this, incredibly impressive studio. We recorded at George Martin's Montserrat Air Studios, where the Police and everybody, you know, all these people. It was very luxurious, very cool. We thought everything was great. And the record was released the same week as the Police and Joe Jackson, and we didn't get any promotional money. Yeah. And they, you know, so it's kind of a very typical story for newer bands with major labels. We weren't able to sell enough records for them to honor their contract. So they let us walk away, but we ended up with no major label again. And, you know, so it, not a great experience. It was very exciting. And, you know, in those days, the whole thing was, can you get a record contract? And we worked and worked and worked. And we did, you know, we made that first level of cutting it. But then we couldn't sustain.
Well, when you were playing as Private Lightning, did you ever play gigs with the Nervous Eaters back then?
We never did. I don't think we ever did. I used to go to see them at the Rat a lot because they were really good. And they were the house band at the Rat. So they would often be there. And like you would go to see somebody who was really doing well at the time. The Police came through, Blondie came through, Dead Boys. And lo and behold, there are the Nervous Eaters opening for the Police and stuff like that. So, you know, I was very familiar with the band.
Well, did you meet Steve Cataldo back then or not?
I met him back then, but, you know, we traveled in kind of different circles. Private Lightning was not a punk rock band. Yeah. We did play the Rat, but we were, you know, kind of a different scene than the bands that really became known as the Rat bands.
Well, how did you wind up in the Reform Nervous Eaters?
Well, it was pretty simple. I got a phone call. Would you be interested in doing this? And my response was immediately yes. And then I found out that I was going to have to commute to Cape Cod to rehearse with them, which is about an hour and a half drive from me. And I just decided it was worth it to be in a band that good. And yeah.
Well, who was it that gave you the call?
Dave McLean, the drummer. He had been the drummer in the Boom Boom Band, which back in the mid-70s, I auditioned for the Boom Boom Band and met Dave at that time. And years later, he's the one who gave me the call for the Nervous Eaters and just, was saying we were trying to think of people that could fill these boots, and your name came up. And would you be interested?
How do those boots feel?
Oh, I love it. I love it. They these are some of the best musicians I've played with. One of the most rehearsed, tightest bands. And I have always admired Steve's vocals and his vocals, his songwriting, and his guitar playing have all been things that I have taken note of over the years. So it was an honor to be considered for this, for this gig.
So the new album, Rockin' Really Hard Away, has been out a week now on the Wicked Cool Records. When and where did you guys record it?
We recorded it at a very small studio in Rhode Island. This was just, we knew the engineer who we really had a lot of respect for. His rates were, great, which is a big thing when you're, setting out to record an album. And we just hunkered down in this small studio and made it work for us. And, we did have a talented engineer, so it worked out well.
And did you do all the songs at the same time or at different sessions?
We did them right at the same time. I think we did like 2.5 days of full band playing and then another week of overdubs.
Now, Mike, liner notes, the notes I was handed, says that Steve produced with, along with your former bass player, Brad Helene. Is that what the production team was?
Yeah, or? we pretty much just sort of allow Steve to get to where he wants to get with it. Brad was very instrumental in kind of keeping things organized.
Our coolest song in the world this week is Inside Out, and this is one that Steve wrote. Is that correct?
That's right.
Do you have any idea how he came up with it?
He's pretty mysterious about his songwriting stuff. He does it on his own. He doesn't bring a lot of stuff to us. He makes great demos, and he just plays us the demos, and we go, wow, great tune, and we learn it, and then rehearse.
Well, one thing I noticed on the album, a couple of songs date from prior releases like New Face and Girl Next Door. Why re-record older tunes?
Well, I think really Steve has, you know, he's had this relationship with recording definitive versions of his songs. And I think he just really felt like he hadn't gotten it. Yeah. And he had this, you know, band that he was pleased with and wanted to hit those songs again. And we, you know, we chose songs from about 20 songs. Yeah. And those, and there were newer ones, but those just seemed like, let's get those right. Let's do those definitive versions.
Well, one of the songs on the new album, Vampire, was issued as a proper 7-inch single, you know, a vinyl record. It's right. Backed with Knockdown Day. Now, did you write Knockdown Day, the B-side?
Yes, I did.
Well, cool. And did you happen to write any of the or any of the tracks on the new album written by you?
Yeah, one that was a single, Don't Need to Make You Mine.
And how was that? Because, you know, Steve's songwriting is pretty synonymous with the Nervous Eaters. He was okay with you contributing to a couple of songs?
Well, he was okay. I played him demos, and mm-hmm. he... I wasn't sure I was going to get the green light, and he loved the songs. You know, it's an interesting side of Steve that he would listen to stuff like this and see it as fitting. But he, he particularly loved Knockdown Day. It's a song that I'm pleased to have written, and he got behind it 100%. And was very happy to have these songs on the album. So, I feel honored again.
So you front your own band in Boston as well. Is that right? The Adam Sherman Band?
That's correct. I do.
Well, how does that differ musically from the Nervous Eaters?
Well, it's more folk rock, I think, than it is. I tend to write very introspective songs that have more to do with lyrics and kind of a folk approach. It's more a songwriter's band, I would say.
Yeah. Well, that comes back from your mother's Bob Dylan record collection.
You bet.
Hey, when is the next Nervous Eaters gig?
Next one is in Providence, Rhode Island at a club called Askew. And that's on Saturday, September 14th.
Very cool. All right. That is now noted. And if somebody just wanted to check out the next Adam Sherman Band gig, what date would they look at?
They would look at September 8th, which is a Sunday. And we have a residency at a club in Cambridge called the Plowin' Stars, which is just a unique and wonderful place. And I feel very fortunate to have this residency. And we've been there for a couple of years every second Sunday. So the next one is September 8th.
You know, I've played the Plowin' Star myself.
Have you been there?
Yes, I have. I play in a band called The Woggles. And,
yeah, I know that. Yeah.
Well, we played there, and it was a lot of fun, man. And climb, you know, see, kind of used the bar there as kind of like a stage for a moment or two, and it was really really great. And we actually had a great dinner too.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you get fed when you play your gig there?
Well, if we want to, we get fed. We usually take the cash, but we get fed, you know.
Well, I hate to think of you playing there on an empty stomach. So
yeah, no, that wouldn't be good. We gotta be fed. We have to have our energy.
So when I was doing trying to do some research for our chat today, I found an interview you did. It's posted to YouTube. I can't think of the guy interviewing you. Maybe his name is Steve.
Steve, yes.
What
Steve,
is his last name?
Ricardo.
Ricardo, that's right. Steve Ricardo. So, and like right at the top of that, the beginning of that, he made some reference to you being a voice teacher. And I wasn't sure if that was a joke or that was a real thing or not. Do you teach voice lessons?
I do.
Okay, well, let's back up a second here because I you know, we're talking of talking about you being a guitar player. How did you wind up being teaching voice lessons?
Well, you know, Private Lightning was, you know, back in the day, you would buy the Phoenix, which was the weekly, you know, alternative paper, and you'd look at the gig section. And I got into Private Lightning through a classified ad in the gig section, and they were looking for a lead singer. Now, I had been a guitar player. I had been a guy in high school that was willing to sing. If you recall, high school, nobody wants to sing in the band. They'll do everything else, but nobody. And I would sing. So I had sort of confidence about that. I auditioned for Private Lightning as a lead singer rather than a guitar player. And as Private Lightning began to get recognition, I started to think, wouldn't it be good if you knew more about singing? Wouldn't that be good? And so I sought out one of the, you know, he was considered to be one of the best. And then I studied with him for 3 years.
Okay.
And this was Merrill Shea. I think he's still giving voice lessons. But I, you know, and then I just sang in a rock band. My voice got better. I got, and then I went on to study with a few other teachers. I studied with a jazz teacher where I learned a lot about using my voice in a different way. And at a certain point, I was trying to figure out, well, how am I going to earn a living now? And I thought, well, you know a lot about this. Maybe you could share some of that with people. And I got into it, and it worked. And I found that the information I had to share was helpful to people. I would fold it in with a guitar lesson too, so I would get singer-songwriters. And I'm still doing this, not so much now, but I'm still teaching.
Wow, that's really cool. All right, well, we're going to hear one more cut from the new album off of Rock and Roll Your Heart Away. It's a tune, Charlene. So this is one of Steve's compositions, is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you have any insight as to how this one came together? Was there a real Charlene?
I don't know. Steve probably changed the name of someone, but he's got a lot of reality in his songs. They tend to be things that he experienced in his life. So I bet there is, if not Charlene, I bet there was, somebody, Earlene or somebody like that.
So the riff to that, this one is really pretty cool, especially at the, the intro and so forth. That's a lick he came up with then, right?
Yeah, that's Steve.
Very cool. Well, Adam, thanks for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, thank you so much, Manfred. This has been great.
Well, we're going to give a listen now to your tune, Charlene. It's off the new album, Rock and Roll Your Heart Away. It's the Nervous Eaters and Little Stevens Underground Garage. With a tad of their tune, Charlene, here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's guitarist, Adam Sherman, for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast, and Kurt Baker for editing. Shel Talmy is a record producer of note. He's American, but back in the 1960s, he relocated to London, where he produced the early Kinks hits and early Who hits, and over the course of the decade, worked with a host of UK artists, including David Bowie, Manfred Mann, Chad and Jeremy, along with the Easy Beats. He also produced our very own Genya Raven when she fronted Goldie and the Gingerbreads. And in the 1980s, he produced our very own Speedy John with his band, the Fuzztones. Shel Talmy, he's my guest next time around on our Coolest Conversations here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Hey, hey, it's rolling time, it's rolling time. Hey, 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 I'm You're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.